We are joined here live in the studios by Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you.
Lots to cover.
Yes.
There is.
There is.
There
so,
is a lot.
Starting, there is a lot, starting with Council Member Sawant.
Yes, this week, Shama Sawant introduced her Tax Amazon resolution to the City Council on Friday. Her resolution references the head tax, that's the otherwise known as the employee hours tax, in the first two paragraphs of the resolution. Then it references the just-released McKinsey report in January on homelessness in King County. That's the report where McKinsey basically said businesses have to pay more if they want to expect to cure the homelessness problem.
And they vastly increased their estimate of how much it would take from even 2 years ago.
McKinsey estimated in that report that it will cost up to $1.1 billion per year over the next decade to build the housing that's needed to keep people housed and off the street. Now, Shama's resolution also makes reference to bills in the state legislature that are trying to preempt any local business wealth tax, including House Bill 2907, which we talked about last week, and Senate Bill 6669, which would only raise about $121 million per year in King County, or about one-tenth of what's needed to house the homeless. The resolution that Sawant introduced calls for five things. It's not a bill to impose a new tax. It's a resolution, and resolutions are the City Council expressing opinions or taking stances on various topics. This resolution calls for five things. One, for the City Council to declare support for taxing wealthy corporations and individuals instead of regressive taxes on the poor and middle class, like an increase in the sales tax, for example. Number two, it asks for the City Council to urge the Washington State Legislature not to amend House Bill 2907, Senate Bill 6669, or any other bill to preempt the ability of Seattle to impose its own tax on big businesses outside of any other authority the legislature grants to King County or other counties. Number three, it asks the City Council to urge the state legislature to remove the cap on the King County tax rate that's in House Bill 2907 and Senate Bill 6669, which is too low to do much good. Number four, it calls for Mayor Jenny Durkan to support these same goals and defend the city's right to impose its own taxes. And it asks, finally, number five, it asks the Office of Intergovernmental Relations in the City of Seattle to communicate this resolution to the Washington State Legislature, to lawmakers in Olympia. So it's not a bill for a new Amazon tax. It's just setting the groundwork for one, and it's defending the city's right to levy its own taxation from the state legislature's current attempts to shut that down.
All right. So that is happening Monday.
Any sense what committee that'll go to?
Well, probably her own committee, and then they'll discuss it. Of course, maybe make changes to it, maybe pass it, maybe it'll die. We don't know yet. But this is just the first week that she just introduced it on Friday.
Right.
I thought it would be important for people to know what's in it, since there's a whole lot of people who panic whenever Shama Sawant introduces anything in the City Council. It's important to get the truth about the things that she's proposing out there.
It's got to be said somewhere.
It has to be said somewhere and talked about in reasonable terms.
Yes.
And it's in response to all the different entities that are lining up and sending out letters at the state legislature.
There's a whole lot of local politicians who are working with the state legislature, Jenny Durkan included, to try to get, and Dow Constantine included, to try to get House Bill 2907 and Senate Bill 6669 passed as a way to preempt any bill that Shama Sawant or her supporters might try to bring forward in the City Council to levy a tax on businesses, particularly on wealthy businesses, to pay for affordable housing and homelessness services. And the idea behind these bills, and there's a lot of motion, there's nothing currently in those bills that would stop the city from levying its own tax. But there are a lot of politicians who are pushing for amendments that would say that this tax would prevent the city and any other cities within King County from levying their own taxes.
I don't understand the problem. I mean, you know, Durkin could collect the taxes and then she could just divert the money to her favorite programs.
I think the idea is that if a bill is brought forward by Shama Sawant and her supporters, it would specifically prevent the mayor from spending the money on whatever she wants to spend it on. And the city council, of course, the mayor can make proposals in the budget during the budget process on what she wants to spend things on, but the city council disposes. It decides where the money will actually go.
Yes, and then Durkin illegally withholds it.
Yes, and you're going to talk about that, aren't you?
Yes, I am. We might as well just jump to that.
Yeah, let's jump into that.
There were some more developments in Durkin's refusal to release the funds for LEAD, the City Council, the Law Enforcement Diversion Program, that City Council passed in its budget last November.
And that the mayor signed.
She is, we mentioned last week that... Lisa Delgard, who's the director of the LEAD program at this point, had sent a letter to the Durkin administration trying to get that money released. And, they got a response this week. Durkin is refusing to release the LEAD money or to recategorize it as a law enforcement, not a homelessness program. Currently, she's got it listed as a homelessness program, and that's important because the city has new guidelines for any homelessness spending that requires data on how much permanent housing they're putting their clients into. That is not the purpose of the law enforcement diversion program. It is a law enforcement program, a criminal justice system program.
It's to reduce criminal recidivism. People who are arrested, the idea is to divert them from jail, get them into treatment, try to treat the reason for why they committed their criminal acts, and to get them out of the criminal justice system into a stable situation. Sometimes that does involve housing them, but not always. A lot of people who are referred to the LEAD program already have housing.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So
it kind of brings up the question, which we can't really answer here, of why Durkin signs budgets that she then turns around and modifies after the fact.
I believe it's a power struggle.
She
signed the budget with the intention of saying that yes, I understand this document to be the opinions of the city council, but
strictly
I am,
advisory.
Yes, but I am the mayor, and therefore I can do what I want, and I'm going to spend the money where I want, and I'm going to place a hold until my highly paid consultants decide whether or not the LEAD program deserves that money.
And I should mention that Durkin did offer something that she called a compromise, which involved funding additional money for LEAD for basically through the second quarter. And the problem with that, of course, is that you can't staff up to meet the demand that LEAD is facing and the backlog of cases that it is currently dealing with. You can't hire people and say, okay, the funding for this position may disappear in 3 months. It's already a tremendous problem with burnout among caseworkers in this field. And you know, it's going to be, and there's a lot of demand for caseworkers. I mean, they don't need to go work for a program that's going to bounce them out in 3 months.
In large part, the burnout is related to the high numbers of clients they have to do, which is why the LEAD program needed the money to hire more case managers to handle the heavy load. And Dogard is right. It's not possible to hire people and say, well, we're just hiring and we can only promise you a job through June 30th. After that, we may have to lay you off. You can't get good people in if you tell them that. And this program is a successful program. It's been a model for other cities who have set up similar programs around the nation. And there's no reason why the mayor can't release the funds and allow them to hire people and promise them at least a year's worth of work.
Yep. So why don't we go to the navigation team from there, since that's related.
Yeah. Now, during the budget negotiations late last year, Councilmember Lisa Herbold succeeded in adding a budget proviso or requirement for the navigation team to continue issuing quarterly reports to the city council in order to get the council to release the funding for their program each quarter. And in addition, she added on a list of questions that she wanted the navigation team and that the other city council members voted to get the navigation team to answer. Now, this week, the navigation team released its report for the fourth quarter of 2019.
And we should emphasize that budget proviso was passed with the past city council, which is not as progressive as the one now.
Yes. I think we can assume that the current city council also, a majority at least, wants answers to these questions. Now, this fourth quarter report covers the months of October through last December. There are some interesting statistics in the report. The navigation team made 810 unduplicated contacts with people. I'm assuming that means people whose encampments were swept. The team made 126 referrals to services, but some people received multiple referrals. They didn't list how many were unduplicated of those referrals. The referrals
That's
ranged,
a lot of people who didn't get referrals.
It is. The referrals that they did make ranged from giving a person a granola bar or a bottle of water to referring them into a drug or alcohol treatment program or to a case management worker. So somewhere well shy of 15% of the contacts or people who were swept were offered any assistance at all. As for shelter, 197 unduplicated referrals were made, but only 45 of those people actually checked into a shelter within 48 hours after they were contacted by the navigation and swept by the navigation team. So less than one quarter of the people, the quote-unquote contacts that were made by the navigation team, were offered shelter, and around 5 to 6% actually managed to come in from the cold after their contact by the navigation team.
After their being swept. Makeshift home was swept, yeah.
Yeah. There were an average of 12 shelter beds open each day during the quarter, 6 of them in enhanced shelters, 5 in basic shelters, and 1 in a tiny house village on average every day. But the navigation team is only managing, according to the earlier statistics I cited, the navigation team is only managing to send one person to a shelter every other day. So availability of shelter beds is not the issue. The issue is how the navigation team operates.
And availability of spots in, say, drug treatment programs or case management for trying to find housing is also badly backlogged.
Yeah. Now, there are two separate scenarios under which the navigation team sweeps an encampment. One is with 72-hour notice and outreach services provided, essentially providing, interviewing people, talking to them, asking them what their needs are, offering them services, building trust before you come in and just, throw their belongings in a dumpster and tell them to move along. Or the navigation team will actually come in and do the latter. They will sweep an encampment without notice if they deem the encampment to be a hazard or an obstruction. And the statistics show which one the navigation team really prefers to do. Of the 303 encampments that were swept, only 11 of them had 72-hour notice plus outreach services provided. That means that over 96% of the encampments that the navigation team encountered and swept were without notice and without anyone really interviewing them, evaluating their needs, trying to build trust with them, and trying to get them the help that they need to get in off the street.
That seems like way higher numbers in the previous quarter.
It does, doesn't it? And that's the trend. That's been the trend throughout 2019 and perhaps earlier. And the city continues to use the lack of shelter space as an excuse for why the navigation team doesn't post 72-hour notices and provide outreach. And yet the average number of daily beds available is a dozen, whereas the navigation team only succeeds in placing one person every other day into shelter. So I don't think availability is the issue. I think the issue is that this is just how the navigation team wants to operate, and that comes from the top, from Mayor Durkin.
I believe that should also be categorized as a law enforcement program,
yes,
not a homelessness.
Not a homelessness, and we've said that before.
It's just criminalizing homelessness and then saying they're they're all breaking the law by trying to sleep somewhere. We'll deal with them that way.
Yeah, yeah. Now, the navigation team has at long last begun developing its racial equity toolkit analysis. That was supposed to have been started back in 2017, but has been on hold for a very, very long time. They've said now that they will use the 2019, that they're beginning the analysis. They don't have results yet, but they're going to use the 2019 data to identify any trends. In the meantime, they began the process by sending two navigation team members to anti-racism trainings. And 14 police officers who've worked with the navigation team have spent a couple of hours each on a training called Acknowledging Hidden Bias. That's the progress they've made so far on dealing with racial equity issues with how the navigation team operates.
Two hours each.
Now, as a little under 2 hours each. As for, and that's at least how the statistics appear in their report. Maybe they reported them wrong. I don't know. But that's what it looks like from the report. Now, as for answering the questions the city council had, because they added that to the budget proviso, we have some questions we want you to answer. The report doesn't really do that. For example, the council asked the Human Services Department, which oversees the navigation team, to compare the standard of care provided by the navigation team to care provided by other homeless outreach agencies, like REACH, for example. The Human Services Department replied that they don't evaluate any agency according to the standards of care developed by the Human Services Department, All Home and REACH. Those are just recommendations. They don't actually evaluate any organization according to those standards of care. Apparently, the only thing that they measure is raw exits, just a number that tells them how many people are exiting homelessness and getting into housing, not whether people are actually helped in any meaningful way, whether they stay in that housing long term, whether they actually completely exit the homelessness trap.
And the city has a long track record of lying with statistics in terms of how many people are in a house.
And interestingly, they didn't even provide that comparison in this report. So after saying, well, we don't measure any of our programs in terms of quality of care or standard of care.
We can tell.
We only measure exits from homelessness. They didn't even provide that number in this report. Now, the council also asked for a table that shows the nature of the obstruction for each encampment that was declared an obstruction and then swept without notice. And these were 92% of the total camps that were swept. Instead of providing that information, the Human Services Department gave a table showing the location of each encampment, the date it was swept, any dates in which an outreach worker visited the camp. Many listings said NA in that column, and the number of quote-unquote contacts made, some of which were duplicated. Again, these contacts may have been giving someone a granola bar or a bottle of water, not anything really meaningful in terms of helping them get off the street. In most of these camps, encampments that they swept, they only made contact with one or two people, or maybe just one person twice, because it was not unduplicated data. They didn't list any reasons for why the camps were swept, and identified no obstructions or hazards in their report, which is exactly what the council specifically asked them to provide. So there you go. Mayor Durkin and the Human Services Department resisting the law as passed by the city council.
Yeah, and the whole idea that the navigation teams help get people off the street, it's simply a lie. It's not the purpose of the program.
No.
The purpose of the program is to move people along when they get complaints from neighbors or businesses or somebody just says, hey, there's an encampment at this location. Can you sweep it? Who knows why those encampments are targeted? We don't know because they're not telling us.
Well, I think we kind of know anyway. You can see it in the letter that Jason Johnson provided when he submitted this quarterly navigation report to the city council, where he emphasizes the public safety aspect, the clean streets aspect of the navigation team's work. It is clearly puts the navigation team within this framework of we are responding to the complaints of businesses and of bourgeois homeowners who don't want to see icky homeless people near their businesses or near their homes. And so when we get complaints phoned into us, that's when we send the nav team to boot people and sweep them along.
Yeah, I'm sure there's an app they can provide that will help people do that.
Yeah, and that's really what the navigation team is. It's not strictly a program. As the Human Services Department likes to say, it's not really a program to move people into housing or get them off the street.
And by the city's own criteria that it requires of shelter providers in terms of getting people into housing, the city set very high goals for those. And, of course, the navigation team is not only spectacularly failing to meet those city standards, but they're doing so at a much higher cost than, mm-hmm. than the shelters are.
And they're not being held to that same standard, which is hypocritical, to say the least.
Well, yeah, those other programs that are providing shelter, like let's say SHARE, that gets its funding cut for not meeting the city's goalposts that are moving.
Mayor continually tries to cut funding for SHARE out of the budget, and the city council has to restore
it. But the navigation team doesn't appear to be hindered by such rules.
Nope, and the navigation team is Mayor Durkin's pet project. She has adopted it and expanded it and thinks it is the best deal going.
I will say it again. It's time for some people to get organized and think about who would be able to mount a credible challenge to her in 2021.
Yeah.
Because she needs one.
Yeah.
All right. And finally.
That's just my opinion.
One last item with the city council. Council member Herbold getting a fine this week.
Yeah. People may remember the kerfuffle last summer when a homeless couple inadvertently parked their RV near a home of a person they were getting some help from. And it happened to be in front of Lisa Herbold's house. And that came immediately. Council member Herbold.
Who was running for re-election.
Yes. And it came immediately in the aftermath of Ari Hoffman floating the idea and Dory Monson picking it up of people parking shoddy RVs, for lack of a better term, in front of council members' houses. So she, not fairly understandably, concluded that this was going to be a problem. And then Monson's fans started showing up for an impromptu demonstration. They defaced the RV, and a Cairo reporter who was fired for this, that's good to know, actually went in to the RV and pronounced it a dump because they had just purchased it and hadn't had a chance to clean it up yet. It's understandable that Herbold would be concerned about this. And, when you're getting threats from the public, particularly as a female politician, you have to take them seriously. So she texted Police Chief Carmen Best and asked her if SPD could investigate. Best declined to investigate and suggested that Herbold call SPD's non-emergency number. Legally, that was probably the proper thing for Best to do. Lisa Herbold got fined $500 for, trying to use her position as a council person for private benefit. That is the security the city does not provide to council members under threat from right-wing yahoos. Everybody came out looking kind of bad on this, but you can be sure, two things out of this. Number one, you can be sure Ari Hoffman, who ran a failed city council campaign last summer, did not make it out of the primary, but has been since been very noisily trying to harass homeless activists and service providers. You can be sure that he and his friend Dory will make hay of this and say, oh, Lisa Herbold has been fined for an ethics violation without saying what it was. So bear in mind that it was a relatively minor violation and it was involving her personal security. Yeah, which is a big deal.
You could argue that the city government should have provided some kind of backup for city council members who are under threat like that.
Absolutely. And Sawant, too, because she got a lot of different threats last year.
Yeah. And, yeah, the difference is that Herbold actually texted Carmen Best, whereas Sawant relies on her supporters for help in this case. So, yeah, you could argue that ethics violation or not, the city probably was falling down on the job there.
And this is the kind of thing that keeps women from running for public
it
office.
It does. A lot of women don't want to deal with that kind, those kind of security issues.
Sure. So, and that's understandable. Mm-hmm. But it's all very unfortunate. The city did not handle it well.
And Herbold was on city council back when, I can't remember how many years back, it wasn't that long ago, when the issue of zoning related to a new stadium came up and the vote came down to that the women council members were voting against the issue and the males were voting for. And the
just kind of broke out
of
that way.
Hate mail that came in from that.
Against the women. Yeah. And a lot of it very sexist and very,
very
violent.
Very misogynist. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of some of the context there for
this.
Those of you playing at home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So right. I thought I would highlight that just because it has some lessons.
Mm-hmm. All right. Moving on to continuing with Maria, your coverage of the state legislature.
The state legislature, just an update on some of the bills. There were some interesting transportation bills that are making their way through the legislature. This week, the House passed House Bill 1110, which would set up a clean fuel standard in Washington state to lower the greenhouse gas emissions from transportation fuels, with the exception of, and there are some exceptions, of course, fuels for airplanes, marine vessels, railroad locomotives, military tactical vehicles and equipment, off-road vehicles used to transport logs, agricultural vehicles, and heavy construction vehicles used for industries like mining and timber harvesting. A lot of exceptions there, but it leaves the largest sector of the transportation industry under the bill. So the bill would apply to passenger automobiles and freight. Now, this bill passed the House last year and died in the Senate. This year, it passed the House 52-44 and is headed to the Senate Environment, Energy, and Technology Committee. So we will see if the Senate takes it up and decides that, yes, this is the year we pass a clean fuel standard.
I would love to see airlines included in that.
I would, too.
The silver lining, I suppose, to the pandemic going on in China is all the flights that have been canceled from China to other parts of the world and how much carbon that saves.
Well, yes, and there's I noticed this morning reading the news that there's a lot of concern now among oil and gas companies and countries that produce oil and gas that the price of oil may drop because of lack of demand from China because the impact that the Wuhan coronavirus has had on the Chinese economy.
And when we get to the coronavirus, I'm going to talk about it in some more detail.
That's also going to help China's carbon emissions drop this year, I think.
Yes. And it will. It's also playing havoc with a lot of U.S. companies that rely on Chinese supply chains.
Yeah,
particularly in healthcare.
So it could have a very serious impact overall on the global economy if it goes on for very long.
Yep.
And it looks like it will. Now, getting back to the state legislature, there are three options for a transportation funding bill in the state legislature that would cover projects over a 15-year period. The current transportation funding bill is covers projects through 2020 this year, but the legislature has to look at a budget for 2021 and for future years. There are three bills that are very, very similar that will cover projects over the 15-year period of 2021 through 2035. All three bills vary from each other in only one real aspect. And that's how they collect the largest single piece of revenue. The first bill would place a carbon tax on all industries in the state. The second bill, the second option, would just levy the carbon tax on the transportation industry. And the third bill would institute a cap and trade program instead of a carbon tax. Now, the first bill would raise the most money. But the second one is not far behind, since the transportation industry is the leading producer of greenhouse gas emissions in Washington state. The third option, the cap and trade program, would produce about 4 to 5% less revenue than a carbon tax would. So they're all pretty comparable. And of course, they all have wide support among the Democrats and not so much among Republicans, and maybe not so much support among conservative suburban Democrats whose constituencies drive long distances to get to work and childcare and so forth. Now, out of a $17 billion transportation budget, almost $13 billion is set aside to be spent for highway maintenance and improvements. That's more than three quarters of the total. So that's not a change from prior transportation budgets, unfortunately. The list of projects that the bill would fund include $3.14 billion for the I-5 bridge replacement over the Columbia River near Vancouver, $1.8 billion for the trestle rebuild on Highway 2, that's from Everett across EB Island, $869 million for roadway maintenance, and $3.5 billion for removing culverts and barriers to fish passage in our state's streams, as mandated by a lawsuit that the state lost. Now, $2.6 billion would go to pay interest and principal on debts and bonds issued for previous projects. Transit, van pools, and buses get about a total of $700 million in the proposed budget. That's about 4% of the total package, while bike and pedestrian improvements total about $315 million, or just under 2%. That is dismal. Now, the remaining amount would go to the state's ferry system, to freight mobility projects, to port district grants, and railroad improvements. All three bills are in the Senate Transportation Committee right now, and they're not expected to pass this year. They're not required to pass until next year. Democrats are looking to push these bills through next year. This year, they're being introduced for discussion and possible amendments. Next year, the legislature will tackle a new two-year budget for the state, and they're expected to look at a transportation budget as well. Now, one transportation bill that's gotten a lot of attention is House Bill 2515, which was introduced in the House Transportation Committee this week. This bill would require the State Transportation Commission to come up with rules and a plan for allowing only electric vehicles to be sold in the state of Washington by the year 2030. They would need to come up with the plan by September of next year, and the new rules would need to be adopted by January 1st, 2024, if this bill passes. This bill will have its first public hearing at 1:30 on Monday in the House Transportation Committee. The bill was sponsored by Nicole Macri, Joe Fitzgibbon, Gail Tarleton, Jerry Pollitt, Zach Hudgens, and other Democrats. It probably won't go anywhere this year, but who knows?
And most of those people are from Seattle.
Yeah. Another important transportation bill that doesn't look like it's going to move out of committee is House Bill 2362, which would allow cities and municipalities to impose local taxes to pay for transportation, including an increase in local sales taxes of 0.4% and various other taxes and fees that cities could impose. This bill is meant to plug the gap if the state Supreme Court eventually rules that I-976, Iman's $30 car tab fee, is constitutional after all. That bill, unfortunately, does not seem to be going anywhere. I think it's probably on hold to see how the court decides on I-976.
Yeah, and that's assuming that the court actually rules before the end of the session.
Yeah. Now, the House version of this bill had its first reading on January 13th, but has had no public hearings and no votes. But the Senate Bill 6652, that's its companion bill, will get a public hearing at 1:30 p.m. on Monday in the Senate Transportation Committee. The Senate bill is sponsored by Joe Wynn, Rebecca Saldana, Liz Lovelett, and Mona Das. So the Senate bill may move. We'll see. Now, a couple of health care bills were also in the news this week. House Bill 2457 passed the Health Care Committee this week and will get a hearing today, in the House Appropriations Committee. House Bill 2457 would establish a health care cost transparency board in Washington State. The board would analyze the growth in health care costs, establish a benchmark, and then identify which health care providers exceed the benchmark each year. So that could be very, very useful for people who want to price shop when it comes to their doctors and their hospitals. Senate Bill 6087 would limit a person's out-of-pocket expenses on insulin to $100 for a one-month supply. This is in direct response to the huge increase in prices of older drugs sold to people who can't live without them, folks who are now a captive market and whom pharmaceutical companies and venture capitalists are making them pay just to stay alive.
And for context, 30 years ago, a vial of insulin cost maybe $10.
Yeah, and not that long ago, it was fairly cheap. Still, it's only recently that prices have shot up to be completely exorbitant. Now, Senate Bill 6087 has passed both the Senate Healthcare Committee and the Ways and Means Committee in the Senate, so it looks like it may move on to the House soon. So that is really good news for folks who rely on insulin to stay alive.
I think there's a couple other states that have already passed
something similar.
Laws.
Like yeah.
That. Yeah.
And EpiPens have gotten a lot of attention also.
Yes, they have. And last but not least this week is Mancadingra's, I hope I pronounced that right, her bill, Senate Bill 6158, which passed the Senate this week and has moved to the House Public Safety Committee. Senate Bill 6158 would create a state task force to standardize how hospitals and clinics throughout the state treat victims of sexual assault. That bill looks like it's on a fast track to pass the legislature, and that is very, very good news.
All right. Well, that takes us on to national and impeachment updates.
Well, let's go in order of huge news stories of the week. That would start with Monday and the Iowa caucuses, yeah, which were a chaotic disaster, to put it mildly. It has been blamed on source code in the app that was used to transmit totals to the state Democratic Party. This was apparently a new app that had never been used before, but had been tested repeatedly. So the question is, how was that source code introduced? And that's not something I've seen anybody talk about.
Yeah, my understanding was that it was not tested extensively in like a real-time test, where you do a trial run of running numbers, submitting them, and then checking them to see if they actually match.
The party actually did do a dry run, but what they did not do is train their volunteers to use the app.
Yeah, and that's what a real-time test would have identified, that if you need more training, then you need more training, and
right,
that will show.
There was multiple reports of different people who were responsible for using the app downloading it while they were at the caucuses that evening.
Yeah, and that's
so
that's
there's
bad.
No way you can figure that out on the fly like that.
Yeah, and that's bad. I mean, if you're going to roll out something like that and tell people to use it, first you have to identify, does everybody have a smartphone, which is
right,
not necessarily true. Does everybody have the app on their phone? Did it install properly? Is it working properly? Can everybody connect and get the data to you when they need to do it? And all three things were points of failure.
And the backup system failure, which hasn't gotten a lot of attention, caucus leaders were supposed to call in the numbers.
Yeah, paper worksheets and then phone in the results.
But the problem was they couldn't call in because something like an online flash mob of Trump fans got the number and decided to bombard that hotline with calls, so nobody could get through. That's the kind of dirty trick that is fairly low tech and easy to replicate. So be aware of future primaries.
Yeah, the phone number was posted on 4chan. So
yeah,
yeah, that is just I think that's just something we have to accept, that the Republican Party is willing to sanction what we would consider criminal activity to disrupt a Democratic election.
The ends justify the means.
Yeah. Now, the New York Times ran an interesting article this week, I think it was on Friday, where they said that they analyzed problems with the Iowa caucus results and found that more than 100 precincts reported results that were internally inconsistent, missing data, or just not possible under the rules of the caucus system in Iowa. They said that math errors are the most common problem, with some precinct vote tallies not adding to the correct total or allocating the wrong number of delegates to some candidates. But in some cases, the official total reported by the Iowa Democratic Party for a precinct was not the same total as what the precinct actually reported to the Iowa Democratic Party.
And this raises the question of particularly for a caucus or primary that's early in the process and is considered really important, mm-hmm. or a really big state like California or Texas, the Democratic National Committee has to be able to oversee that.
Yeah.
They had some people on the ground there, but they didn't anticipate the problems.
Yeah. Now, some of the errors were minor, but not all of them. Part of the problem, of course, as we said, were the new rules in Iowa, which were very complex, and they required multiple reports of first the first round results, then the results of the final round of votes, and then finally the allocation of delegates. So those three reports that had to be made it much more complicated. Instead of simply reporting the allocation of delegates as they had in prior years. Now, an example is that 15 precincts so far that they've analyzed so far, there was a candidate which received fewer delegates than another candidate, even though the first candidate had more final round votes. So yeah. How does that happen? The errors are serious enough to actually call into question who the winner of the Iowa caucuses is, because it's so close between Pete Buttigieg and Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, and I want to take a moment just to acknowledge, this also got kind of buried in all the news, the real milestone of having an openly gay man apparently win a presidential primary caucus in a mm-hmm. major party.
Yeah.
That has never happened before, and it's something we should be proud of, whether you like Buttigieg's politics or not.
He did well.
He did well, and he did well in a state that is fairly conservative culturally.
Mm-hmm.
Although, to be fair, Iowa was...
He's
one of the,
very fairly conservative
well,
in
yes,
his politics, though.
Of course. But mm-hmm. To be fair, Iowa was one of the first states to legalize gay marriage, so there's that, too.
Yeah. Now, one of the examples I want to cite in the analysis of the Iowa caucuses results is that on Wednesday, the Iowa Democratic Party initially reported that candidate Deval Patrick, and if you're like me, you're saying, who? What they reported that he was sweeping up delegates in central Des Moines. But later, they came back and determined that, oh, that was an error. Those were delegates that belonged to Bernie Sanders. Okay. And then at the same time, they had reported that they reported the Deval Patrick error. They reported that when they reversed the Deval Patrick error, they reported that delegates for Elizabeth Warren in central Des Moines were mistakenly reported as belonging to Tom Steyer, so they had to reallocate her
Oops.
Delegates as well. So that's pretty serious when you announce results on Wednesday and then have to come back and say, oh no, sorry, we gave delegates to another candidate that don't belong to them. We have to change that. And the candidates who lost delegates in that initial reporting process, if it hadn't been fixed, were the two most liberal candidates, Bernie Sanders
yeah.
and Elizabeth Warren. And so that might lead people to be really highly suspicious of how the caucuses were run.
A lot of Sanders people are exactly that.
Yeah.
The only real winner out of that chaos is Trump, because, I mean, you can see the campaign ads right now. I make the trades run on time. He can't even count your votes.
Mm-hmm.
It's the sort of self-inflicted error the Democrats historically have been very good at, and hopefully we won't see more of that.
Yeah, hopefully we won't see more of that. And it really, I think, points to why a lot of states have moved to the primary rather than the caucus system. And here in Washington State, this will be the first year that the Democrats will honor the results of the primary vote rather than require a caucus.
And they moved it up so that there will actually be a number of candidates on the ballot, and it might actually make a difference. It's the week after Super Tuesday, so it's coming up in about a month.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, not too long from now.
And we're also about 2 weeks away from the deadline where if you want to vote in that, you have to be declared as a Democrat to do so. So it's actually less than 2 weeks as of today. So people will need to do that if they want to participate.
Yeah, because mm-hmm. in the past, especially in the caucus system, all you had to do is walk in and sign a paper saying you were a Democrat. You didn't have to do it in advance. This mm-hmm. year you do.
This year you do.
So, that was Monday.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes.
This is the week that was. Tuesday was Trump's State of the Id speech, where he basically held something of a cross between a campaign rally and a game show, without any particularly serious policy proposals in terms of things that Congress would even remotely consider. But he did give Rush Limbaugh the Congressional Medal of Honor, which honestly, and it doesn't matter whether Rush Limbaugh has been diagnosed with cancer. That's unfortunate for him, certainly. But and giving it to him on the floor of the Congress during the speech, as opposed to the usual ceremony in the West Wing. So this is somebody who will flout convention and ignore guidelines in favor of making political points. Not that that's a surprise, but it's yet another example. And we're going to see a lot more of that, I think, as the campaign season goes on.
Yeah, so those Republicans who voted not to impeach him, like Susan Collins, for example, who said that they hoped Trump would learn a lesson from all this, are sadly mistaken.
I think that's already been being proven wrong.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I think he has learned a lesson from it. It's that he can get away with even more.
Yeah, and that he can continue the same old stuff he's been doing all along.
Yep.
All right.
So we'll have new impeachment articles in about a week.
Yeah. So Wednesday was the vote on impeachment in the Senate.
Yeah, and that was, I actually watched all of it, which I need a life. but it was... it was illuminating, and there was an interesting op-ed in the New York Times by Senator Sherrod Brown the following day saying that many of his Republican colleagues knew perfectly well that Trump was guilty and that he was unfit to be a commander-in-chief, but they were too afraid of the backlash from Trump and from his supporters, and that's why they voted to acquit him. That's not a good reason to acquit somebody. I'll just state the obvious. I think it reemphasizes that the task this fall is not only to win and to win back the White House, but to do so, number one, in large enough numbers that it can't be monkey wrenched, and number two, that in large enough numbers that the Senate comes along with it. There is a very good prospect of Democrats taking back the Senate if they don't blow it this fall.
Yeah, and I think the Republican Party needs to be shown that doing this sort of cowardly caving in to Donald Trump really is going to cost them.
I would hope so, because it certainly violates the oath that they took, not only in their office, but the oath they took at the beginning of the impeachment trial.
I was shocked at the number of them who basically said openly, yeah, we think what Trump did was wrong, and quite a number of us think it was criminal. But we're not going to vote to impeach him. We're going to leave that to the voters to decide, essentially saying that they don't believe that impeachment is one of their duties of their job.
Which it is.
Yeah, which it is. That they don't believe that the impeachment process is a real process, which it is. And essentially saying that even if it is a real process, we're not going to do our job.
And given that one of those articles was... obstruction for refusing to hand over subpoenas to Congress. Mm-hmm. As a package, it's basically the Senate Republicans giving up oversight for the oversight function of Congress on the executive branch, which is written into the Constitution.
Checks and balances here.
Yeah, that's.
And if you don't understand checks and balances, you shouldn't be in Congress.
Yeah, and that's why the only thing the Senate has been passing this past couple of years is Trump nominations of judges. Because they want to stack the courts as well. And they're able to do that because the last couple of years of Obama's last term, they refused to even process any of his judicial nominations, not just Merrick Garland at the Supreme Court, but all up and down the chain in the federal courts. And those are the vacancies that are being filled now.
All right. Well, then that takes us on to a Friday night. We're skipping over Thursday and moving.
Yeah, Thursday we were drinking heavily. So I don't really remember what happened. last night we had the seventh Democratic debate. This one was in New Hampshire in advance of the primary next Tuesday. Seven people on the stage, one more than last time because Andrew Yang was added back, which would have made it a more diverse panel. It would have been helpful if the moderators, who I think did the worst job of any of the debates that I've seen so far.
And who were the moderators?
ABC News. Okay. So Stephanopoulos and somebody else, I forget who. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't ask anything about race until Tom Steyer brought it up as a sort of sidebar to a different question, saying, by the way, the moderators haven't asked anything about race. And remarkably, the next question was about race. And they gave it to Pete Buttigieg. And then they asked for a response from another white guy. And then finally, Andrew Yang got to say something.
Yeah.
It was a bad scene. They did not get to time it changed until after 2 hours had passed. And any sensible people had tuned out or waited for the highlights. And they did not ask anything at all about immigration, which
is amazing, given that that is one of the most contentious issues in Congress right now, particularly in the House, among the House Democratic majority, looking at the Trump administration's violations of federal immigration law and the way that the Trump administration is abusing the immigration and homeland security system.
Yeah. And I should probably transition from that into an international item, which is that Human Rights Watch put out a report late this week, which, again, hasn't gotten much attention, tracking 200 Salvadorans who were deported back to Salvador from the United States under the Trump administration's
policies.
So
what happens to folks when they're deported?
Yes. Well, 134 of them were murdered. Almost all of them were murdered, raped, or tortured. That tells you what people are fleeing, and that they were legitimate asylum claims, and the Trump administration basically sent them to their deaths. The Trump administration has death tolls. Mm-hmm. And that's information that really should be out there more widely.
Yeah, so when they don't inter them in subhuman conditions in detention facilities near the border, they send them back to almost certain death.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a reason that people are desperate enough to flee their own home and their own country and, you know, basically walk 2,000 miles to try and get refuge. And that refuge is being denied right now. Mm-hmm. And they're being told their lives don't matter, which is not a surprise from the Trump administration, but very telling.
All right. That takes us then on to international and the coronavirus.
Yeah, let's talk about that. It keeps spreading widely. It's considered a pandemic in China now. There are 34,878 confirmed cases. That's nearly double what we reported last week on the show.
So highly contagious. So, and the definition of pandemic is that it be epidemic in more than one country. So I think it's two or
more. And that's happening, too.
That is true. There are places in Japan now where...
Japan and Singapore, yeah, especially.
Where people are in quarantine because of it. And it's spread to Europe and the United States.
And there was an interesting study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, which mm-hmm. is fairly, you know, high-level medical journal, tracing the epidemiology of it. And what they were saying was that, some 50% of the original cases in Wuhan didn't stem from one person, but they stem from hospitals. And we also saw that this week the death of the Chinese doctor who first tried to alert Chinese authorities to this and was basically shunned for his efforts before they finally had to admit something was very, very, very wrong.
Now, a couple things.
And that's creating an online political crisis in China right now.
Yeah. Now, a couple things about why the Wuhan coronavirus, or they call it the 2019 novel coronavirus, is so...
The Wuhan Chamber of Commerce would like you to leave them out of it.
Yeah. There's a couple of reasons why it's so communicable. One is that younger people tend not to get as sick as older people, so it's not clear right off the bat whether a young person has just a standard cold, the flu, or this new coronavirus, and they can be contagious and spread it around without precautions being taken, because the assumption is that it's just a head cold or an allergy or something. And the other issue is that sometimes people don't get the standard symptoms. So the novel coronavirus was initially identified as affecting the upper respiratory tract, particularly the lungs, and giving you a fever. But some people experience nausea and diarrhea instead, symptoms of the flu, but they end up having the coronavirus, and they can spread it if they're not isolated. And that was the case in one hospital in Wuhan, where a patient had entered with what seemed to be flu symptoms and was on a regular ward, was being treated on a regular ward, and spread it to 10 healthcare workers and at least 4 other patients in the same ward before they determined that that patient had the coronavirus, because they didn't have the standard symptoms. So that's the other thing that makes the novel coronavirus particularly contagious.
Well, the other piece of it is that you can have it and be spreading it for up to 5 days before you have any symptoms at all. That's a huge problem.
Particularly in young people. Yeah, yeah. In older people, you tend to come down with it and get sick faster. But that's another thing that they've noticed, is that you can have very mild symptoms or almost no symptoms for the first 5 days and not get particularly badly sick until day 6 or day 7. Yeah. And you can be spreading it all that time until you get seriously sick and it's determined that you have the coronavirus.
So I think for the foreseeable future, those numbers are continue to, you know, double each week or so. There's over 700 dead now, which is a huge death toll, really, for something like this.
Well, I don't know. I mean, thousands of people die from the flu every year. So the flu can be very deadly as well. I think we don't quite know yet what the lethality of the coronavirus is, but it's very clear it's highly contagious. People do not have a lot of resistance to it. So, and that's probably because it's new.
It didn't exist 2 months ago.
Yes, and that's because it's new. And that's where that combination of there not being a reservoir of resistance to it within the human population, plus the highly contagious nature of it, is where healthcare officials are really concerned that it could cause a very high death toll and cause a lot of disruption.
And the other piece of this, the majority of Chinese deaths, I mean, there have been plenty outside Hubei province, which is where Wuhan is, but the vast majority of deaths have been within Hubei province. It's like a 4%+ mortality rate, which is much higher than has been reported elsewhere. So we don't really know how it spreads. We don't really know what curtails its spread. We don't really know how to treat it yet. Although, you know, there's some people are trying to develop some things, obviously.
Yeah, in China, they announced that they had an inoculation they were testing.
Yes. Well, we'll see if that works.
We'll see if it works.
Yeah, but this is being it's a political crisis within China. It's also going to have a huge impact on the global economy. Because China is such a hub for manufacturing around the world, most shipments from China have been canceled now. As I mentioned earlier, most flights from China have been canceled now. And there are a lot of American companies that rely on Chinese supply chains. Maybe the Bush administration or the Trump administration planted this as a way to get American jobs back. It's a really tragic situation, and one that could get even more out of control in the coming weeks.
Events.
Yeah. Tomorrow is the Tax Amazon Action Conference. That's Sunday, February 9th, from noon to 4 p.m. at Washington Hall at 153 14th Avenue, about a block north of Yesler Way in the Central District. And then Monday, February 10th, the City Council will be discussing Shama Sawant's bill to end winter evictions. That bill appears to be moving through the City Council and may be amended on Monday. So if you support that bill, it's important to show up and show your support for it.
What time?
That's at 1 p.m. at City Hall at 3rd and James in the second floor City Council chambers.
All right. Get there early. There will be a line.
Yeah.
All right. So we will see you both here next week.
That's the plan.